We have a special guest, Roshi John Daito-Lori from New York State. I'd like to welcome you.
No, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
You've just written a new book called The Zen of Creativity.
That's right.
I had an opportunity to look through this amazing book, and you're originally a student of Roshi from Los Angeles?
That's correct. Hakuryu Taizan Maizumi.
Maizumi Roshi.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess the thing that I'd like to start out with is, as a Zen priest, you came to Zen through photography.
Yes.
And you were a student of Minor White?
Yes.
I have looked a little bit at photography myself, and I've gotten Minor White's Zone Manual, but I've always wondered, it seemed that that was awfully technical, and with your book, The Zen of Creativity, it really brought some light to Minor White's intuition and his awareness.
Yeah. One of the main points that Minor and Ansel Adams, who developed that zone system, were trying to make is that it's possible to pre-visualize, to see in the mind's eye the image before the exposure was made.
Mm-hmm.
And the zone system was a technique to help people do that. And also a technique to help people calibrate their equipment, because no two enlargers function the same way, no two cameras function the same way. And so what you do in order to work with the zone system is to calibrate your film, calibrate your camera, calibrate the enlarger and your darkroom technique. And once that's standardized, you know, when you take a light reading of a subject, you can see in your mind's eye in black and white exactly how the different tones are going to be rendered in the final print. So photography doesn't become an accident, it becomes a very conscious act of creation. That's what the zone system enabled. And a lot of people resisted the zone system because it's so technical. But the technicality just exists in the beginning. Once you begin using that, you don't even need a light meter. I had students who were studying with me who were interested in doing documentary photography. And particularly in those days, it was documentary photography, during the Vietnam War protests where things were happening very fast, photojournalism, that sort of thing. Well, once you've really mastered the technique, you don't even need a light meter. You become a light meter. I mean, you know the speed of the film, you know what your camera can do, and you know what the exposures are, and you can react spontaneously in spite of this complex technical calibration thing that's behind the whole process.
And in the process of the technical calibration, is that more accustoming oneself to a range of tone value that is produced by each element? Is that right? Or I'm wondering about how one calibrates.
Well, film has a range of sensitivity. So
right.
When you're going to calibrate, you can't do it with a roll of film. You have to do it with a... You buy film in bulk.
Right.
And you load your own cassettes.
Mm-hmm. And use a gray card. And
use a gray card.
Mm-hmm.
And then you make a series of exposures identical for all four. So what you do is you take a reading on the gray card.
Mm-hmm.
I hope this is going to make sense to your audience. I mean, you have to be a photographer to love this kind of talk.
Well, there's going to be a... I want to bring this also back to a Zen principle.
Sure. So you make an exposure. Then you open the aperture stop, make another exposure, open another stop, another exposure, and so on.
Oh.
About five or six exposures. Then you go down
right.
a stop, and another stop, another stop. And you do that for all four rolls of film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now you develop the first roll on the prescribed development time that the manufacturer suggests. Second roll, increase it by 10%. Third roll, decrease it by 10%.
Mm-hmm.
Fourth roll, wait until you develop the other three and see what you're going to do with them.
Right, right.
The one that gives you 10 zones because you don't always get 10 zones, is the one that you're going to work with. And now you can find out by increasing another 10% how you can get 11 zones, or how you can decrease to get 9 zones. So you can increase contrast or decrease contrast by your development time.
And it becomes very intuitive.
Yeah, after you get to know your camera and your film, it becomes very intuitive.
As I had mentioned to you, I'm a piano technician, and each piano wants something a little bit different. Like going to somebody's grandma who makes these wonderful rolls, and you say, well, how do you make those, grandma? And, well, it's flour and salt and sugar. Well, how much? Oh, enough.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Until it tastes good. But the Zen principle I thought about when you were speaking was about when the student first approaches Zen, mountains are mountains and waters are waters. And then an intermediate student will experience mountains no longer being mountains and waters no longer being mountains because the sense of unity is understood. But then the advanced student understands that mountains are mountains and waters are waters again. But, and this is something I had learned from one of the lectures of Alan Watts, one can be playful with that, with how, can you comment more about that?
Well, I mean, you know, there are certain things that we need to do in order to train ourselves in our way of seeing, no matter what the skill is. I mean, if you want to play a violin, you got to practice. You need to train. You need to do it every day. And once you've achieved a certain level of proficiency, you're then free with the violin. If you want to be an Olympic swimmer, say, coach, I want to be an Olympic swimmer. Coach says, okay, this is what you have to do. Get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, do 100 push-ups, swim 50 laps of the pool, don't eat this, eat that, be in bed at 9:30, no alcohol, and so on. And you do this month after month, year after year, and you become proficient. This is discipline. Now, you take that person who is totally disciplined as a swimmer and take a non-swimmer, drop them both in the middle of a lake, the swimmer is free. Swimmer's mastered the water. The other guy just sinks to the bottom. So what we're talking about in any field is developing, through discipline, personal discipline, the skills of that media, that field, and out of that will come this spontaneity and freedom where you can now throw away all of that that led you.
Because it doesn't get in the way.
It will get in the way if you get stuck with that. And that's what we call the golden chain, you know.
Oh.
Although it's valuable.
Oh, stuck with the discipline, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Sure. I had an idea, and I continue to think about this, about inviting people to become transparent to themselves. Because one of my experiences is in tuning a piano. When the piano is tuned to the peak of its capability, the piano goes away.
Mm.
And just the music is there. But it came through my many long years of discipline with understanding what tuning was all about and bringing the resonances to the point where there was this transparency that showed up. And I guess I was reading your book. I was thinking about, in pre-visualizing a photograph, after you have the discipline of the calibration, you've accustomed your mind's eye then to see these tone values.
Do it to see in black and white.
That's fascinating. And I thought about the word creative audience. And you have groups of people that give you feedback about your photographs. And I saw the one photograph of the stone that you took when people were skinny dipping, and I thought that was just wonderful, a wonderful story. Can you tell us that story?
Well, that was a time that I went out photographing to a very favorite spot along the Delaware River up north. And I was feeling particularly spiritual this day. And I had just recently finished the workshops with Minor White. And so I hauled my big 8x10 camera, 4x5 camera, and began photographing. and doing all the things he said, you know, sit in the presence of the subject and, you know, open yourself up to it and let the subject reveal itself. And I was going through this whole process and making images, and I could hear a lot of giggling and noise upriver. And it kept distracting me. And it became the itch that I couldn't scratch, so I had to go up there and check it out. So I went up there, and as I came over the rise, I realized there was a whole group of people skinny dipping. And I watched them enjoying themselves for a few minutes and said, you know, I got to get back to work. So I left, went back, and continued my work, you know, expressing spirituality. And I finished the work, brought it home, processed it, made some working prints, and sat down with a creative audience, and I started getting feedback, you know. And feedback is not whether you like the image or don't like the image or whether it's good or bad. It's about sharing your feelings of the image. So people agree to open themselves up to it. And they started telling me how sensuous these images were. And these are pictures of rocks. They're all rocks. Sexy, sensuous, and I'm hearing all these words, and I said, what are these people talking about? You know, I mean, where are their minds, you know? I began to realize, you know, after hearing it enough, that where was my mind when I was making the images? That I hadn't let go of the skinny dippers. I'd come back to these rocks, and what I was feeling is what I was getting. So the image becomes a mirror of the self. The image becomes a guru, a teacher. When you have, you can work with a creative audience, it can, because you're going to photograph or you're going to create what's on your mind or what's happening, what you're feeling. Not what you think, but really what's going on inside your body. And that's what was going on with me. And I would not have realized it had it not been for this creative audience. So I began to realize I couldn't see what they were talking about, that I needed to consciously make sensuous images and sexy images, you know, of rocks. And when I could do that at will, I will have mastered that barrier and could go beyond it.
Okay. So it's actually then another calibration then.
It's a con more than a calibration. Well, I was just going to say that it's these art koans or visual koans that I use in the book to help people get in touch with feelings rather than ideas, because that's what we're expressing when we create art. We're expressing our feelings. And many people are not in touch with their feelings. I mean, our society is such that we kind of protect ourselves from that. We insulate ourselves. And so to open up to feelings means to allow yourself to become vulnerable. And it's hard to do.
It's scary.
Yeah, it is.
But in a way, when one sits with a point of stillness, as I wanted to also thank you so much for my being able to attend to that, there comes actually a trust when one completely abandons what one thinks of oneself to that point of stillness.
Mm-hmm. Well, even the process itself, you know, when you start sitting, and let's say you're just working with the breath, each time your mind drifts off and you acknowledge the thought and let it go and come back to the breath, you empower yourself. You empower yourself with the ability that you can put your mind where you want it, when you want it there, for as long as you want it there. That builds confidence. It builds confidence little by little, day by day.
Breath by breath.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And confidence overpowers arrogance. When you're confident, you don't have to be arrogant. You know, you can be okay. You can be soft. You can be vulnerable. You can be open.
I wish some of our current leaders would come yes. to that point.
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
The reason I'm laughing is, is years ago in 1980, there was a big peace march on the East Coast, and we were a stop-off place. The monastery was a stop. People were walking across the country and going to New York City for this demonstration, and they had to stop at the monastery and stay overnight. We were a stop-off place. That day happened to be each month our liturgy we dedicate to the successive presidents of the United States and to the peace of the world. Well, you know, I had 100 protesters in the Zendo. The president was Ronald Reagan at the time.
Oh, boy.
And the service was over. I went back to the Abbacy, and I'm in there changing out of my robes, and I look out the window, and here's this big bunch of people coming down the road, and I said, uh-oh. They all gathered at the door, and they said, how can you do that? You know, how can you dedicate, you know, a Buddhist service to, you know, Ronald Reagan, after all, what he's doing, you know? And I said, wouldn't you like to see Ronald Reagan experience enlightenment? Wouldn't you like to see him be a bodhisattva? I mean, what a different world we would have, and a different kind of presidency that we had. That's what the dedication was about.
Mm-hmm. And it's trust in the self, beyond oneself.
Well, if he could forget the self, what would be left? The people of the world. The United States. No self.
And we're back speaking with Roshi Luri. Welcome back, Roshi.
Thank you.
Before the break, we were talking about the feedback that you get from... Can you explain that?
The creative audience.
The creative audience, yeah.
Yeah. You know, what the creative audience provides is an insight into what an artist's art is communicating. Every artist knows whether people like their art or don't like their art. The critics tell them that. The buyers tell them that by buying it. Publishers tell them that. The gallery owners tell them, you know, by purchasing. What they don't know is what the experience of the audience is of the art. And what the creative audience does is provides that. It's an agreement to open up to a work of art and see how it feels. Not what you think, not whether you like it or don't like it, but how it feels. And as I was saying before, that's a very difficult thing. In order to do that, you need to be kind of vulnerable and open to it. And you need to be in touch with your feelings. Mm-hmm. So it takes time to train a creative audience. I've found that, you know, when I'm working with a creative audience, what I get is their thoughts about the art rather than their feelings. And it's hard to communicate, you know, what does it mean to feel something? Not to think about it, not to analyze it, not to judge it, but feel it.
How do you invite people to come to that place in opening, I suppose?
Yeah, well, first of all, it starts with their willingness to learn about it. You know, unless that's there, unless they have a student mind about this, it's not going to work. And then it means nailing them when they slip off into, you know, intellectualizing it. And they'll say, you know, that's fine, but how does it feel? You know, what part of the body is involved? When you enter the painting, when you imagine yourself in the painting, are there any sounds? Is it cold? Is it warm? How does it feel underfoot? How does it feel to touch the surfaces there? Are there any smells? Let all of the senses become involved. Because what happens, taking your favorite, you know, your interest in photography, a person climbs a mountain, you know, on the top of the mountain, and they begin to see a sunset. And they take a photograph. And then they look at the photograph later and they say, this is not the way it was. Of course not, it's not the way it was. I mean, a sunset is not a two-dimensional surface on a piece of paper. What else was going on? So you're standing on that mountaintop. You hear the birds singing. You feel the breeze. You feel the ground under your feet. You smell the fragrance in the air. All of that, the whole body and mind is involved in seeing, not just the eye, the ear, touch, smell, sound, all of it comes together to create the experience, and it's that experience that you're trying to communicate. So unless you're in touch with the experience, you're not going to communicate it. Unless you're in touch with what the Taoists call qi or qi, the same qi that's in qigong, the same qi that's in tai chi, that everything has that spirit, that energy. And if the spirit of a mountain or a sunset doesn't end up in the painting's dead. If it doesn't end up in the poem is just dead words. So the key needs to be conveyed. And the only way you feel the key is to stop your own internal dialogue, reach that still point, and be able to open up to receive what's in front of you.
And that actually leads into the next thing that I wanted to speak about, and I do want to come back in a moment to the creative audience, but the creative process on page 86 of your new book, The Zen of Creativity, you talk about the creative process, about breathing, and about moving into the hara, and about the chi, which is the breathing spirit, the living spirit of the mountain, of the sunset, of the word, even though it's beyond the word. And I think that's what I sense sometimes when I'm not, when I'm very vulnerable and I'm tuning a piano, then there's chi, the chi of that piano comes through because the piano isn't there anymore, but there's something so magical about it. But can you also talk more about the fourth and fifth step, about the resonance and the expression, and about how the creative audience informs you as an artist or a photographer?
Well, I mean, the resonance, one of the things that's important, central. Again, let me go back to photography and use that as an example. However, it's equally applicable to any of the art forms. When I work with students, I ask them, I give them koans, visual koans. A visual koan is a koan that can only be solved visually. And koans are specifically designed to short-circuit the whole intellectual process, you know. In order to see a koan, you need to make a kind of a quantum leap of consciousness and go into a different realm other than linear sequential thought. So I give a koan, for example, I might ask them to make love with light, to photograph a feeling of love that they have for some person, place, or thing other than the subject, which means that they're going to need to get in touch with love, the feeling of love, not the idea of love, not Hallmark greeting cards, love, you know, running down the beach hand in hand into the sunset, but how does it feel? And they're going to need to find a visual metaphor for that, not the person that they love or the thing that they love. They need to find a visual equivalent that evokes the same feeling so that they recognize it when they see it. And I ask them to go out without any preconceived notion of what they're going to find. It needs to be a process of discovery. And I ask them to go out with that feeling of love in their hara, a point two or three fingers below the navel. When they're moving through a landscape, tuned into that, when they enter the space where their image is, they begin to feel an intensification of that feeling. They still haven't
found... In the hara.
Yeah, they still haven't found the subject. What's going on is resonance, same kind of resonance that happens when you strike a tuning fork and bring it close to another tuning fork, and the energy goes from the one to the other, and they both start vibrating at the same frequency. Well, that same resonance, that same coupling of vibrational frequencies happens not only between tuning forks, but between people, between a person and an inanimate object, or an animal, or a mountain, or a river. And so when that resonance begins to happen, the intensity is felt in the hara. And you, as you move closer to your subject, because you're being beckoned by the subject, it gets stronger. If you're moving away from it, it gets weaker. So you use that almost as a radar to kind of find the subject. And when you finally see it, you'll recognize it. And then you need to sit with the subject and wait for your presence to be acknowledged. It doesn't matter whether it's a tree or a rock or a person or a frog. You wait to be acknowledged. You just don't shove a camera in their face, you know, and start making pictures. Once you're acknowledged, the process begins. And you'll find that the subject has many faces. I mean, an inanimate rock has many faces. As the light changes, as your own consciousness changes as you sit with it, you begin to see different aspects of it. So it begins to, layers of faces begin to reveal themselves. When the right one appears, and you're sitting there, you've taken care of your exposure and all that stuff with your hand on the trigger, you know, the shutter release, you make an exposure. If the exposure got it, there's a sense of completion, of release. Just you hear the buzz of the shutter, you know you've got it. If you haven't, there's no sense of release, so you keep working until you get it. When you've got it, you then thank the subject, you bow to it, let it go, and go on to the next thing. So that's the resonance. What it's seeing is the key, what I'm calling the faces of the subject, is the key, the spirit of that thing that's being. It comes from the subject to the artist, to the art, and then eventually to the audience, so that they're all connected.
Many people, the observers, don't feel that they are one of the elements, sadly. Mm. And they feel apart from that.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem of the art and the artist, I think. You know, mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that the Zen arts always does. It kind of pulls people into the art. Mm-hmm. And it does that by, you know, by leaving a little bit unfinished that the audience has to finish, you know, a little bit unsaid, a little bit hidden that you have to kind of work to get, whether it's in poetry or paintings or whatever. The mystery needs a certain sense of mystery needs to be present.
I think more than anything else you've said today, that really strikes very deeply in me, and thank you for that. That's to not try and complete it. I heard a lecture by Katagiri Roshi, who was an abbot at the Minnesota Zen Center, or I think it may have been Suzuki, I can't remember, but he said, leave something for the students to do.
Mm-hmm.
And this is that same sort of spirit. Don't try and do everything.
I think it was implicit in the title of his book, which was, the name of the book was, You Have to Say Something.
Oh, yes. Yes. I'd like to also ask you, you are a Roshi in both Soto sect and Rinzai.
Yes.
What is the difference? I've studied mostly Soto Zen.
I mean, the basic difference is the people who think there's a difference. It's like all duality.
You got me.
Okay.
Is that good enough?
That's good enough. The other thing before we close that I wanted to ask about was, with this creative process, if you could speak about the net of jewels, please, about how everything is reflected in everything else.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you know, thousands of years ago in the Avatamsaka Sutra, there's a description of a thing called the diamond net of Indra. And in this net of Indra, the universe is seen as a net of diamonds that exists throughout time and space. I mean, this is before Einstein, you know, 2,000 years ago. And each diamond is multifaceted, and each diamond contains every other diamond. So that if you look at one diamond, you'll see every other diamond in the universe, past, present, future. If you move one diamond, every diamond in the universe vibrates, moves. As one comes into being, they all come into being. So there's a mutual arising, interdependency, and a kind of timelessness. So for centuries, you know, this has been in Buddhist literature, and this is the way Buddhists see the universe, and most people figured, well, you know, it's just this kind of primitive Buddhist metaphor. Until the 20th century and the discovery of laser light. And what they found is that if you take laser light and you make an exposure of a three-dimensional subject, like an audience of people, you end up with a photographic plate, and if you send laser light back through that photographic plate, you can project a three-dimensional image of that same audience.
The hologram.
Mm-hmm. So you can move among the people, right? Which is remarkable, but there's something even more remarkable, and that is that if you take that piece of film, cut it in half, and project through half of it, you still project the entire image. No one's left out. And if you cut the half in half, and the quarter in half, and the eighth in half, to the smallest piece of film and project through it, you still have the entire image. It's a little lighter and dimmer, but all of the information is there. So all of the information is contained in any piece of that film that's contained in the whole piece of film. The hologram is the diamond net. Same principle. And what that, of course, led to now is, you know, the holographic universe, the new physics, the new biology, the new psychology. It's a way of understanding the universe very different than the way we thought it was.
Well, we have to wrap up, and I say I'm very regretful to have to do that. But everything is reflected in everything else, as each one of us is reflected in each other ones of us. Mm-hmm. So there is no separation. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with us, Roshi Laurie.